about how you can get in touch with him, you can go to his website and look up all wonderful things on his website. And that's markmatusik.com. And he spells his last name MATOUSEK, markmatusik.com. Or you can go to seekersforum.com. So maybe that'll be easier for you to get there, because he does offer guided writing sessions and all sorts of wonderful things. So look that up. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. So all of those ways to look up his work. I want to go to turning our deficits and our faults and our personalities, what we might consider our faults, into assets. And you have a particular one that you did, which I identify with because I do the same thing. And it's how I got through early days in my life. So talk about how you turned a deficit into an asset in your life.
Sure. I was one of those kids. I was very lost and isolated and, you know, pretty unhappy. I grew up in a family where there was a lot of violence and trauma and difficulty. And so I became one of those kids who couldn't stop asking questions. I would just buttonhole people and ask them the most personal questions you can imagine. And they actually would answer. And I found that I could connect when I asked people questions. And it was very obnoxious for some people, and other people loved it. What I learned very early is that people want to tell you their story. I learned that as a very young kid. Just ask. People want to tell you their story. Anyway, so this was a kind of a compulsion for me. And instead of it becoming a detriment for me, I turned it into a career, first as a journalist, asking questions. Then I worked at Interview Magazine, you know, asking questions. Then I became a memoir writer. It was all about asking, you know, yourself questions. Now the work I do with students is all about helping people explore their own stories. So I kind of have an insatiable appetite for people's inner lives. And it's been with me since I was a kid. And as I say in the book, if I had, you know, one degree differently, I might have ended up the town drunk, you know, sitting kind of boring people in a bar with questions. But I managed to turn it into something that has meaning for me.
And it really connects you with people immediately. I mean, as you say, if they realize there's someone there to receive their stories, it becomes a tremendous engagement with others. And so those of us who are shy or introverted, hey, go for this one. This one really works. It'll bring you out and lead you into some marvelous moments with others. And what I'm reminded of is a wonderful quote that you mentioned that Ralph Waldo Emerson spoke or wrote, maybe, and he prophesied something. And I just love this. I hold that ecstasy will be found normal, an example of a higher plane of the same gentle gravitation by which stones fall and rivers run. I just love that quote that it will be so natural for us to live in this kind of exuberant, awesome relationship to all of life, that it'll be so natural, like the rivers running or stones falling. Do you agree?
Oh, I completely agree. Emerson was a mystic to his core, and he really truly believed that the vitality, the erotic power of nature, is what animates us in our lives. And the more we surrender to that natural vitality, the more awake we are, not only to the things around us, but to what we cannot see, you know, to the invisible world. And he was very attuned to the invisible world. And ecstasy is about being off center. It's about expanding our center and expanding our circumference, you could say. And that's what he was all about. He saw that as our natural way of being, and the way we live now as an unnatural way, a shrunken way of looking at the world.
Well, I know, too, he saw back in the 1800s what quantum physicists are coming to now, that it's all about consciousness. It wasn't the material. I mean, he really saw it, that we were walking around like phantoms. Do you remember what he said about that?
Well, one thing he said, which was also blasphemous, is that you call it Christianity, I call it consciousness. You know, for him, it was all about consciousness. He didn't see Christ as an avatar in the sort of traditional way. He saw him as an enlightened being, in the way that the Buddha was an enlightened being. And it was all for him a play of consciousness and waking up to this larger movement of consciousness that's moving through us. You know, another thing he talks about is that we don't choose our thoughts. You know, that we're receiving a download from the universe all the time, that God, in his language, God is thinking through us. And when you open your mind that way and consider your own thinking that way, it gives it a nobility, and it also gives it a kind of grandeur that we're just not used to.
And I know that he was dialectical in his thinking, so he could look at life through many perspectives. He could hold paradox or ambiguity in his thinking, whereas, you know, here in these days, so many people are very binary in their thinking. It's either or, us and them. And this may have been, I think you mentioned in the book that the Bhagavad Gita, that East Indian text, spiritual text, was very important to him.
It was his favorite book. They used to call him around Concord, Massachusetts, they called him the Yankee Hindu. That was his nickname. It was as important a book to him as the Bible was. And he talked about the law of compensation, which is that for every sweet, there's a sour, you know, for every sour, there's a sweet, that every virtue you have can also be a downfall. Every downfall you have can also be turned into a virtue. He was completely paradoxical in how he looked at human nature. And celebrating our contradictions, that was a big thing. You know, he talks a lot about originality and embracing your contradictions, seeing that your limitations are actually part of what makes you original. You know, he famously said, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. You know, trying to be monolithic, one thing, binary, as you're saying, under one label, is a recipe for a shrunken and artificial life. You know, in our authenticity, we incorporate and house many things. You know, we're stingy and generous and scared and brave and selfish and all in one day. And so to expand our acceptance of that is what self-reliance is about. It's allowing yourself to live in the whole as who you are, including what we call the shadow. And if we don't incorporate that, then we lose strength. It's like standing, he says somewhere, it's like trying to stand upside down, you know, when you're not allowing all of who you are to be in the room, so to speak.
Yes, yes. There's another part in some of the lessons that you share with us from his thoughts. It's called a resilience without confidence. In the universe is against you. Without confidence, the universe is against you. And I thought it was interesting that you brought up the word confidence and in relation to resilience, because years ago I was at a gathering with the Dalai Lama, and he mentioned the word confidence in the context of spirituality. And I was taken back by that. And so what can you say about confidence in spiritual practice?
Well, confidence comes from the root with faith, con fidelis. So it means having faith in oneself, having trust in oneself. And Emerson talked about that creating a kind of magnetism so that when we are in our own center, when we're telling the truth, it has a magnetic effect on the people around us. We tend to magnetize experiences to us when we have confidence, when we're taking our own seat, as they say in Buddhism. Taking your own seat is what confidence is about. And it's about allowing yourself to speak the truth. It's about not imitating other people. It's about not getting hung up on being too good. That's another thing Emerson rails against. He says your goodness must have some edge to it, else it is none. You know, we live in this self-righteous, moralistic time when everyone's trying to one-up everybody else in terms of virtue signaling and being too good. He loathed that because the true goodness has edge to it. He said, a little wickedness is good to make muscle, he said. Very humane. You know, he was not, for being idealistic in certain ways, when it came to human nature, he was extremely realistic and compassionate around the complexity that all of us are working with and trying to integrate.
So I get the feeling he was no goody two-shoes. I mean, he really looked very, very clearly at himself, at his foibles, at his upside and downside, and he encourages us to do the same.
And that's one of the reasons he loved Thoreau so much, because Thoreau was a complete rascal. You know, Thoreau couldn't care less what anyone thought about him. And by comparison, Emerson was actually pretty buttoned up.
Yeah.
Temperamentally, he was, you know, he was a Boston Brahmin. He was an introvert. And he wanted to be more like Thoreau and not care about
right.
that. But, you know.
Right, exactly, exactly. So I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Mark Matusik, and he's a wonderful writer, has many, many books, and his current book is Lessons from an American Stoic, How Emerson Can Change Your Life. And if you want to know more about the work that he does in the world, in the workshops and intensives and the guided writing sessions that he does, you can go to his website, markmatusik.com. He spells his last name Matusek, or if it's easier, go to seekersforum.com, or you can go to the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. You can get there for any of those. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Mark Matusik, and we're talking about Emerson and the Transcendentalist and all sorts of wonderful, deep wisdom that can apply to our lives here and now, right today. And you mentioned, Mark, before the break, you mentioned Thoreau, and there's a piece that you included in the book, Thoreau and Whitman and so many others, even people today. I know Andrew Harvey, I'm calling him to mind, and other people that you mentioned. But this is about Thoreau, and he, if when I read this little piece, if you substitute his saying post office, if you substitute that with the internet, emails, texts, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, or whatever else you use, if you think of it in terms of that, here's what Thoreau wrote. He said, "In proportion as our inward life fails, we go more constantly and desperately to the post office. You may depend on it, that poor fellow who walks away with the greatest number of letters, proud of his extensive correspondence, has not heard from himself this long while." I love that. He could be writing, if any one of us, "Oh, I've got so many followers on Facebook, and oh, I'm so popular," and all of that. But what he's really saying there, and I think Emerson is saying, is checking in with ourselves. I mean, they're really talking about, hey, don't let the world interfere with some inner process that's necessary in a truly fulfilling life. I'd love to hear what you have to say about that, Mark.
That's exactly what he was saying, that when we look outward for approval, for to imitate others, for a sense of our own worth, we are sunk. And that we really do need to spend what he called a well-spent hour a day with ourselves. In whatever way that appeals, it can be in nature, it can be journaling, it can be reading, prayer. It doesn't matter. It's about being quiet with ourselves. That's where we're nourished. That's where our deep wisdom comes from. Also, if we're interested in bringing our genius into the world, what he called genius, which is our own originality, that only comes from within. That doesn't come from, you know, trying to copy what somebody else has done. So it's absolutely imperative to keep our eyes on our inner life. And it doesn't mean becoming antisocial. It doesn't mean tuning the world out. It just means shifting the proportion. You know, most of us live too much engaged with what's going on out there. We need to switch that proportion. You know, so 30% external, 70% internal. You know, it's a way of working against this tendency, particularly with social media, this tendency to lose ourselves through influencers and through what we're told by people who have nothing to do with our lives.
Exactly. Another thing that he covers that's really very surprising, and it's something that's up in our culture right now, it's everybody, the new spiritual practice is non-dualism. I mean, it's big time right now, the non-dualistic way. But they were talking about this, he and others were talking about this way, way, way before, in the 1800s, and the connection of life. They were really kind of looking at quantum entanglement. They understood that, even though this is something that came into physics in the 20th century. So say something about non-duality and why that was important to them and to us now.
Well, it's hugely important. And you're right. The word is get so bandied around. But all it goes back to Vedanta. It goes back to our fundamental understanding of coming out of the one, and that we are all part of the one. Advaita, which is a part of Hinduism that focuses on non-duality, means not two. So it's recognizing that we are not two. That's where that this separation is an optical illusion, which everyone from Patanjali to Einstein recognized, that this is there's an optical delusion of consciousness. And Emerson was aware of it as well. So you're right, it's nothing new. And it's part of the pantheism that I've been talking about, the sense of there being no difference between the tree you're looking at and the one who is looking, that this is a unity, that there is seeing, that's what's going on. And that's the way Emerson saw it long before anyone was talking about mindfulness practice or non-duality in his world. He never used that term, but it runs through all of his work, the yeah. sense of the wholeness and of all of us participating with what he called the one mind. We're all part of this one mind, and everything else is a story. Everything else is some egotistical, ego-driven narrative about specialness or separation. The fact is we are all parts of this one body. And that was how he was a naturalist at heart. And he saw philosophy and spirituality through a naturalist lens. So he really did see us as cells in the same body. And then there was no contradiction between individuality and unity, that they were both part of the same thing. It's both and. And that goes back to the dialectical thinking that you were talking about earlier. Everything is both and.
And then that makes us part of all of humanity in some ways. I mean, that we're one intimate circle. In these times of polarization and everything, to really come into what he would consider the loving kindness practice that the Buddhists do. And I'd love for you to say something about the advantage of that kind of practice and how we can bring it into our lives.
He saw human life as a kind of circle. And he saw the purpose of life was to draw people toward your own circle, the circle of your compassion, the circle of your attention, the circle of your heart. The idea was to expand the circle, as Peter Singer wrote a book famously using that title. To expand the circle is to connect with the world. And it's also to recognize our own true nature. Emerson did not want us to get hung up on appearances. And that's another thing that he would have driven him crazy in this time of identity politics. It's all about what makes us different. And no one says nearly enough about the commonality, because that doesn't make interesting politics. You know, tribalism is all about surfaces and appearances and difference. And as long as we move down that path of tribalism and difference, we're going to, you know, stay in the same violent, hellish situation that we're in now. So Emerson's talking about expand the circle, you know, recognize the unity underneath the differences, the ocean underneath the waves. When you forget the ocean underneath the waves, you've lost a sense of what is true and real.
And what has true depth, yeah. Another subject that is brought up is the subject of fear. And there's a wonderful piece that you have in the book about how fear produces antibodies in the immune system. And there's also a social antibodies that's kind of active, overly active in the world today, and how we can be fearful by irrelevant causes.
Yeah.
You know, we pick up things that just have really no reason for us to be fearful. And that's right. Fearful of the other, of otherness, I think.
Sure. What happens is we overreact to fear in the same way that the immune system that goes into overdrive leads to autoimmune disease. It's overreacting to stimuli. And that's what we do socially now, because we live in this age of PTSD, where there's this feeling of trauma. It's trauma waiting to happen. And it takes almost nothing to kick it off and to trigger it. Whoever knew that that you'd have to give trigger warnings before you give a lecture for fear of kicking off somebody's latent, overactive, terror response? And that's what's happening is that our social immune system is in overdrive, and it's turned against itself. And that's when you get cancel culture. That's when you get this inability to tolerate difference. It's just too scary. If you're in a traumatized state, if you're looking at the world through traumatized eyes, everything looks that isn't you looks like an enemy. And that's where we are now. So it's division and rancor and enmity waiting to happen. And that's a dangerous place to be.
So the kind of antidote to that would be?
Well, two things. First of all, to recognize the other in yourself, that the other is you, going back to what we're saying about no separation, non-duality, recognizing your universal common origin. And it's also confronting our fears. And this is something that he's very adamant about. You know, he says you must always, always, always do what you fear to do. And that the only way through fear is to look it in the face, to approach fear. That's when it starts to change. You know, when you avoid it, that's when it becomes monolithic and overwhelming. So it's really about looking closely at fear and analyzing it, understanding where it comes from so that it doesn't stop you, because exactly. It will. We have exactly. This self-protective mechanism that will stop us if we're not careful.
Exactly. Oh, Mark, we could go on and on. Thank you so much for being with us. I've been speaking with Mark Matusik, author of Lessons from an American Stoic, How Emerson Can Change Your Life. And if you want to know more about his work, go to seekersforum.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3801.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Ron Pevney, author of Conscious Living, Conscious Aging. And next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how conscious eldering can help us to embrace and savor our next chapter.
He could be 30. He could be 50. Life has aged him beyond his years. A shopping cart carries everything he owns. Here he comes, toward you. What you think you know about how he got here is probably wrong. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM. broadcasting to you from Simon Fraser University's Burnaby campus in British Columbia.
To CJ.